This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Tom lived in Western Poland, in an area that had been part of Germany until the end of World War II. He describes how his grandmother settled in this area and the strangeness of taking over formerly German houses and apartments. Tom's grandfather on his mother's side was a communist activist who worked for the Polish security services, which created some tension as Tom's father had dodged the draft into the Polish army. Tom describes his childhood in some detail, highlighting the contrasts of life in Cold War Poland versus some of the other Warsaw Pact countries, such as how the Boy Scouts and the Catholic Church managed to coexist with the communist government. He is 11 years old when the Free Trade Union Solidarity is made illegal and martial law is declared by the Polish communist authorities. We end with the poignant story of his grandmother's experiences as a forced labourer in Germany during World War II. I'm delighted to welcome Tom back to our Cold War conversation.
I was born in Jawor, a little town in southwest Poland, actually in the vicinity of Legnica, Wrocław, which is Lower Silesia region in Poland, bordering with Czech, today's Czech Republic, and Germany. So I had like 100 miles to Germany or 50 miles to Czech Republic, but area which were Polish from 1945. So it's still a bit, you know, different, and you felt a bit different than, you know, let's say Poland proper.
So this area was part of Germany before 1945, and then in 1945, the German population were evicted, forced out, and forced to leave these areas because the area was going to become part of Poland under the Potsdam Agreement.
Yes, correct. It's absolutely right. And reason why it's worth to talk about this as well is till 70s, people who lived there, who were born there, you know, after war, I mean Polish people, they still were convinced or in mindset that this area, this region, will be back to Germany. So they only temporary there. There was no mindset like, okay, we stay this forever, it's ours, or it's our homeland now. It was always kind of temporary, you know, feeling in this, you know, approach. So no one cared about building left or heritage left by Germans. It was just like, let's grab as much as you can because tomorrow I might be evicted again.
Were people just given flats or houses to move into? Were they just allocated these buildings, and inside these buildings had the previous occupants just left stuff behind in them?
In many occasions, yeah, I think yes. You know, we're talking about late 40s, early 50s, but I can only repeat stories from my grandparents. My grandma from my mother's side, she was forced labor in Germany, so on the way back to Poland she was walking literally on foot to Poland several hundred miles, and in this when she approached this area, you know, still halfway to her home, she met some, let's say, Polish communist commissar in, it was June 45 or something. And she was like young, 18s or 90s years old. And he convinced her, oh, don't go back to central Poland, you know, to home. It's still poor area. It's still, you know, poverty. It's, look, there's really rich, you know, rich houses. Everything's there. Mechanized agriculture. Convincing her to stay, you know, in this newly acquired, you know, area, so Silesia. So she looked around, she knew Germany from her forced labor, and she spoke some, you know, German. And she decided, okay, I'm going to family, just let them know I'm still alive, and I'm coming back to this area because this opportunity is there. And she met the, you know, her future, you know, my granddad, future husband in 45. But it was like loads of people were just following kind of propaganda, let's, you know, settle these rich areas. It's just like, we know this from movies, from Hollywood movies, like going to the West in the US, you know, in America, you know, there's some opportunities, some rich lands there you can just colonize. And this was quite similar, you know, in terms of movement. Lots of people, especially those who were kind of poverty or still affected by war, they just like move. And many and people try to escape from prosecutions, from Soviet prosecution, because, you know, when you live in close environment like village, everyone knows you, a small town, so they know. So you try to escape, like pointing out, oh, he was in the, you know, patriotic movement or something, anti-Soviet. So they try to change, like drop identity, go to the west part of newly acquired area, Poland, grab new identity and live, you know, their life like different way.
So we've mentioned briefly there your grandmother. Who else was in your family?
My grandmother, I said she met, you know, her future husband in this area. Her future husband, my granddad, he, as a young chap, 17 years old, he joined this Polish communist army, which was created by Soviets. And he was in 4th division of, you know, Polish People's Army at the end of the war on 45. And he find himself in the position when suddenly communist government decide that one of these division has to be converted as a security forces. Like Russian has KGB, GRU. Those people suddenly became this interior, Ministry of Interior Affairs. They were not in military. They used to call it Urząd Bezpieczeństwa, UB, future SB, Służba Bezpieczeństwa. And first allocation was in these western areas. He was secure industry staff. So he didn't join the security forces, but he became one, involuntary. And because he was good money, he came from very poor, poverty family background near Warsaw. So he said, okay, I'm staying here, I'm doing career within this. He just got up to some point when he was even chief for some local region, like, let's say, or, you know, of town or this security in 70s, as I remember. And he retired early. But yeah, he believed in communism because he was before Second World War communist activist. He worked for very hard in industrial area for nothing. So he was like activists, you know, let's say this time. And he believed, you know, I remember he really had massive breakdown, mental breakdown, when in 1980 Solidarity Movement started. He couldn't believe that it's finished, it's collapsed, it's communist idea is totally bankrupt and everything. And soon after he died, he couldn't bear this, you know.
I can imagine sort of your whole world is falling apart.
Irony is, he was really true believer, you know. And very few people actually were true believers in Poland, you know. Most of them who actually create this, you know, system, they were opportunists. They were the four, who has the power, who has the money, and they were like following this, you know, trail. So there was no really any ideology behind a part of, you know, a power grab and money grab. And okay, so this is my one part. Another part was my dad, who came to this Western area, you know, and because he tried to avoid conscription. In 1968, I think it was, 67, 68. Wherever you lived, you had to register with authorities your stay there. So by doing, by changing places of work and living, my dad, because it's some bureaucratic process. So he tried to avoid conscription, just like buying time, because each time it took some few months. Then after these few months, okay, moving further, and the same process again and again. And he nearly managed to extend this for 3 years, really, jumping from all over the western part of Poland. You know, he was in Bydgoszcz, which is north, in the west, some near Poznań. Finally, he ended with Jawor, where, you know, I was born. He met my mother, and because he met my mother, he decided, okay, I like this woman, and he stayed there. And because he extended so much, army couldn't conscript him anymore because he was too old for conscription. So they decided to put him like NCO school or some, you know, kind of course training, which is 6 months to 9 months, and you were like very low grade of NCO. Because he, in between, he was graduating electronics and stuff. So they decide, okay, we're not going to put you in total in a, you know, army boots in barracks as a proper conscript. We're going to put you in some army school, NCO school. You're going to have easier life there, but we're still going to get you. Yeah, he did his 1 year, less than 1 year, 9 month service. And then he was called a few times for trainings. He never was in the army, as you know, we know the conscription.
I think you said to me that he was involved in the invasion of Czechoslovakia in 68.
They were riding BTR with some sort of electronic equipment. I mean, BTR personal carrier. They were told it's going to be friendly stuff. They're going to, you know, exercise trainings in Czechoslovakia. But when he found himself there in Czechoslovakia, in the Olomouc region, he said people were really hostile towards them, which they was surprised, because they thought, okay, we are from Poland. We always anti-Russians. Why you don't like us? We have, but Czechs didn't, you know, just people from Czechoslovakia were really not talking with them, not selling them stuff in shops. He said it was very difficult, even when they ask for direction, when they go, so they always give in wrong direction or totally misleading. Locals used to, in the evening, even steal things of them, that they have to guard their vehicle. They had to always be on alert, but not be robbed, you know, of stuff. Feeling that you're not welcome, you go away as soon as you can.
So what was his family's background? Were any of them members of the party or fans of the communists?
No, actually, it was opposite way. His granddad and, you know, all this part of family was very patriotic, let's say this way. Before war, my great-granddad and granddad were activists of Polish Socialist Party, which dates back to the Tsarist, even, you know, time. So 1905 or something, so they were always. But because they were carpenters and joiners, so private business, when the Russian came, they tried to survive. So they, obviously, there was only three parties allowed you can join. Communist, let's say Communist Party in brackets, because they were not real communists. Anyway, PZPR, Polska Zjednoczona Partia Robotnicza, and one orientated for people working on the land, agriculture. And the third one was orientated for small business, because small business was still allowed in Communist Poland. So they tried to grab an intelligentsia, like Russians say. So people who working in school, teachers, kind of people who work in universities giving lecture, all the people who write books, I mean literary people who do research, scientists, that kind of people of brain, I would say. So, and this party was trying to target them, which was called Democratic Party. They never had a chance to get any big, you know, fraction of votes or something, because every election was fixed, you know, in terms of results. But they always were guaranteed like 10% of their, you know, seats in parliament to just please, you know, intelligent, you know. So my grandparents from father's family, they decide to join this party for peace of mind because they want to run business. You have to be part of, let's say, system somehow to be allowed to function in this system. So they did. But anyway, regardless of this, they were still very active members of local community then in central Poland. They were active members of church community, Catholic. So my dad, from this background, he was running away from conscript because he was full of the, I'm not going to serve the communist, you know, army or something. So my granddad, actually, he was ideal. No, your son, go try to this trick and maybe you avoid conscript and come back. But my dad never come back. He would stay in the West because we used to call it West for some reason. The part where I was born is always called, we in Poland we used to call it West. They're like, it was never properly bonded with the rest of Poland. Even, you know, when I was, you know, in my 20s with colleagues from different parts of Poland, when I was in uni, we used to always, when we're talking about, so other parts of Poland where you used to have regional names, but once you're talking about former German name, German land, most common, you know, word for this was West. Oh, you are from West or something. There was no Silesia, no Pomern, you know, Pomerania, Pomern, or other areas. No, you are from West. Or you in West something. It was like some kind of mental division between people from other parts, you know, Poland, and people who live in this, you know, after 45, you know, acquired region.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more. Your grandfather, the true believer, must have been overjoyed that your daughter had married into this family.
Tell you what, when I was a kid, there was some weird thing, but I didn't really pick up tension within my family, especially when it was in terms of like big family meetings. And then within time, I realized, hang on, we had no such, apart of two or three big occasion, we didn't have such meeting. So if one grandparents came to visit us, others stay far away and opposite way around. They, only on just two or three occasions, they met together. I think on a wedding of my parents, obviously. But later when, you know, kids, two or three. We used to go for like holidays, stay for 1 week with one grandparents or another. But I can't remember they actually meeting each other together. And then it popped in, you know, after some times, hang on, the way they talk, oh, they they slag, you know, slagging off each other, like, oh, this communist, some very, you know, nasty words. They do something to our family. So my grandfather is patriotic. Oh, my grandson, let's go to see like war cemetery from 1939, our truly proper army, you know, when we had this campaigning and we lost to, you know, Nazi Germany. Oh, let's, you know, that's kind of trying to do some patriotic stuff with me. I was still, let's say, 7, 8 years, 9 old. Then I was going on summertime to my grandparents, other side. That one retired, you know, security forces. He loved hunting, so they settled in a local village near town where I was born. So he loved hunting and a little farm going, you know, with his friends. And they were going on hunting, and then, oh, so he tried to bribe me with, oh, grandson, let's go and shoot some, you know, rabbits, or, you know, but when he talked about other side of family, oh, they posh starts, you know, the nose up or something, they don't know real life, you're gonna learn proper real life. They stay away, you know, from each other path. So actually, I never witnessed clash between them.
A tough balancing act there for your parents, but it sounds like they reasonably successfully carried it off. Your mum and dad, what did they work?
My mum was a teacher, was qualified in uni as a teacher. And she was teacher at the beginning of her career for a few years, in early 70s. But later she chose career path, so became like inspector of education with local authorities, and she just stepped up the ladders, career ladders. In the end, she was head of the office of education in local district, and she was doing inspection programs and stuff. So she retired in mid-90s, I think. Mid-90s or late 90s, something like that. But she was always within education. And my dad, well, because of his hobby or something, he was at the beginning, after high school or college, electrician, but or electronic, I can't remember. How to say, radio, building, repairing radios stuff. Then he did graduate within uni to be not proper, like, but after he had like very career was very, not smooth or easy, you know, going because of this. First, he started this sky school or college with electronics. Then he tried to avoid conscription. So a few years, he had break within. He still was doing job as qualified, let's say, technician, because he didn't get full qualification because he had to, let's say, avoid the conscription. Once this army business finished, he could finish his full education. So finally, he was graduated as an engineer with doing like radios, televisions. And in the end, he worked in a Polish factory who was building stereo stuff, I mean stereo sets, Diora, in Dzierżoniów and Jawor. Yeah, we had another. It was a big factory, big business in still communist Poland. But after open markets, it collapsed because it was poorly managed. So in terms of technical stuff, they were doing quite well. Well, good project, but they couldn't cope with let's say modern management. Even markets that opened in early 90s, they couldn't sell their stuff because they were still learning how to manage.
What is your earliest childhood memory? of that time?
Few times being on holidays, 7 years old, 8 years old, on the holidays with my parents. It was holidays when you were granted, let's say, authorities by profession. Like mom, it was from mom's side. This Minister of Education used to grant you some kind of vacation holidays, let's say holiday center. In a lake, Polish Lake District, Mazuria, or seaside town or something. And we used to go to the lakes, you know, in our small Fiat 126, whole family. Me, my brother, who was like 2-3 years old, so small, little baby, and two adults and luggage for 2 weeks. And how we could squeeze this in one, you know, Fiat 126, and it was quite new. Again, even vehicles you get only when you are, when authority were happy with you, because our first, you know, it was second car, but that one first I remember properly, was like you got voucher from authorities, and you could buy the vehicle from, again, authority control vehicle factory, Fiat, in Warsaw. But you have to as well have your own money. So not only you had to, you know, get your money for purchase, but you couldn't purchase without this extra voucher. Even how you can purchase vehicle, you know, new vehicle from official, let's say, way, it was still controlled by the authorities in 70s, I remember. Same happened with our allocation of our flat, because I remember when we lived still with my grandparents in three-bedroom flat. So you have two adults, two grandparents, two another adults, my parents, me and my little brother, and all in three-bedroom flat, because there was no other way. And my mom did a petition. You had to write petition or something, asking, like, if you're lucky enough, you could be allocated fresh flat in big block of, how you know, of flats. Usually there were 10 stories blocks of flats, very small, but it was, so we live in big, you know, area when it's lots of people lived, block of flat, several tower blocks of flats. And I remember it was my childhood, and with other kids of the, you know, you just socialized yourself. Then no one actually could control you. I mean, no one bothered to control. You just grown up on a, you know, not on a street, but in this area between block of flat, but there were still buildings, so we were going in wandering around, you know, with gangs of 5, 6, 10 kids the same age. I mean, 8 to 10 years old, trying to occupies ourselves. There was no really much. Where they're building this area, you know, they forgot always about a football pitch or any playground area. They were the last one to build. We just use everything we had as a playground, really. And that no one then been hurt, it's unbelievable, but I can't remember any nasty story that anyone got hurt. We literally, we were played with fire, literally bonfires starting in some weird places. We were told many times off by adults, you know, chasing us around or something, but no one got hurt.
So you were, it's like living on a building site.
Yes, yes. On the beginning, it was early 70s, and early 70s Poland was very quickly trying to develop. It was time when Gierek, first secretary of Communist Party, tried to catch up with Western Europe. So on the loads of loan money, borrowed money, he tried to jump in terms of quality of living. And in every loads of towns, cities, they got this new estate areas with block of flats because they were quickest and easiest to build accommodation for people. They bought, I think, technology of block of flats from France or something, but obviously quality was different. So soon after, I think in the 80s, people realized the living in this block of flats is hell. The quality of finish was not there. Whoever wants to live in comfy situation, like nice flat, had to finish it himself, which cost lots of money. When they finished building, there was no cleanup, so you still had like leftover from building site. Even some machinery, when they broke down and got rusty there.
I was interested you talking about the Fiat, because this was the Fiat car, because this was the Polski Fiat that was built under license in Poland, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Yes, Fiat 126. Let's say, in theory, everyone could afford, because the official price was not set up high, so it was affordable. But as I said, a part of money you had to hand is like voucher from authorities to purchase one. And there was always black market on this. And I remember one of my uncles was not involved in black market, but used this way to quick earn extra money because he got voucher, he got money, but he didn't need car. He hadn't got a driving license. So even, you know, it was, but he got this voucher. So first thing, he grabbed our granddad. They went to buy, you know, new Fiat. And the same day, they went on this place, was like a market, you know, like you have market town once a week with groceries, something. So Gouda was like market, but for vehicles. So I think it was the same day or following day as they purchased, they went there and sold this Fiat. I think it was 1 to 10, you know, this money. So let's say if they bought for 1,000, they were selling for 10,000, you know. It was the difference between official price and real one, real market price.
That's a great return on that. What was your school life like, Tom?
Well, it was like two different schools I was attending. Primary school, I don't remember quite well because I hated. We used to, it was 70s, we had to wear, let's say, uniforms. Like you have in British school uniforms. So, and in 70s in Polish school, like in following Soviet model, I mean Russian model, we had to wear uniforms in primary school. We used to have blue, as I remember, blue tops with white collars. These uniforms were made by state factory with very poor quality, so they were like itching. We hate this. Collars were stiff. I'm talking from perspective of 8-7 years old, you know, kid. And on top, when we approach 80s, when it was really shortages of everything, these uniforms start to become like nylon, you know. And they were bloody flammable, proper flammable stuff. See, it was instantly, you can just be like torch, you know, if near, you know, live flame wow. anywhere. So they were very dangerous. And after a few accidents, I think, even in our school, not that anyone was badly hurt, but it was quite spontaneous combustion with big flames. And then suddenly, because it was like quick flame and then totally extinguished because there was nothing left actually to burn. But after this, they stopped making this uniforms, and we allowed having our own tops, you know, I mean, jumpers, whatever, whoever wants to wear, on the condition that it must be navy blue. but there was no regulation anymore about how it looks in terms of fashion, you know, pockets and stuff. We still had to, in this primary school, wear something navy blue on the top. And that was kind of agreement, because even state couldn't provide you with proper garments, you know, to wear. But it was first time when I felt proper state oppression.
So it's the first time as a kid you felt the weight of the state.
Well, you know, I'm in quite a funny way, you know, but really I didn't like these uniforms. And we love, with a few other, you know, my colleagues, because we used to, you know, stay to play football after something. We really hate them. They were really not properly fit, so they were just restrict your movements. When you just, you know, let's say such young, you're just even jumping over the fence to neighbors, you know, fruit tree to grab some apples, you know, steal apples from the neighbor and back. And these uniforms you had to wear, well, when you had to wear, we try to take them off instantly after school. But sometimes when it was very hot weather, you had nothing else, so you have to keep them. And they were restricting your movement. Even playing on a, you know, football pitch after school, it was sweaty, actually. You sweat like hell in them. And I'm talking about playing after school because, again, people need to understand that in Poland, most of the parents were working. Working class, no one could afford actually childcare, and there were very few places in state organized nurseries or preschool centers. They were state organized, they were cheap, they are affordable, but not many of them, and they were working only till 3 o'clock afternoon. But when you have school which finish four, sometimes we've even finished 5 o'clock in primary school, literally, because so in Soviet type of education, we were so busy, we're so overloaded with different discourses across the day. So sometimes we finish 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And then we always try to find this little 1 hour at least for our self activity. People were running free around the school area. This football pitch was near school. And our parents were working till 5, 4, 5, sometimes 6 o'clock. So we were not looked after by parents. We looked after ourselves or neighbors. And we used to stay at school ground, play the different, not only football, there were different plays. And suddenly voices in the street, "Oh, Mark, come home. Your dad is back." You know, the neighbors were shouting, you know, you could hear shouts across the street, your name. And your mom's calling you, go there. And you lived like 4 or 5 streets further down. But all this, you know, shouting post or shouting calls, you know, came to you just to call if it's time to back home.
Was there anything like the Young Pioneers in Poland that you had to join?
Yes. There was Scouts movement, which tried to keep us independent from the state, from the communist authorities, but they have to compromise always. So in the end, the Scout movement was kind of compromised. They pretended to be not really pro-state, pro-authorities, but they were, when they were needed or some like official celebration, something, they were the pioneers, like Soviet style pioneers that you have. No, there were attempts in 50s, but it didn't go on. It wasn't really successful, so they stopped. There was another when I was in college in 80s, late 80s, there was movement, what do I say, Friends of Towarzystwo Przyjaźni Polsko-Radzieckiej, which is a society of friendship, of Polish-Russian friendship. They try to make it, you know, let's say, movement from more able, capable, older, you know, kids, teenagers, under impression that it's keep the friendship between our two nations, Polish and Russian. Usually you were, they would try to, not conscript, but persuade you to join when we had foreign language lessons, which Russian was mandatory as a one foreign language in Polish school. So, bless them, teachers of Russian language had this task to enlist as many as they could, let's say, members of this society, under different promises, because people were promised, if you join, you could have visits to, I told you, of, well, neighborhood town, Legnica, there was HQ of Soviet forces. And it was like Berlin, divided by in half by wall, and there was Russian perimeter. So they promised that if you join this Polish-Russian friendship society, you could go with, you're going to get special pass and go to the shop in this Russian, you know, Soviet perimeter, because their shops were mint, they were big. We had empty shelves in the late 80s. They had everything on the shelves. So having passed the Russian perimeter in Legnica, in this quarters, it was a big win because you could buy loads of stuff there and then, either for your consumption or to sell on the black market. Another one, maybe in the future you can go to Soviet Union for holidays to Crimea. Crimea was the magnet, you know, for Polish, let's say, members of this society, because yeah, we're talking about Black Sea side, Black Sea seaside, exotic fruits. Oranges were still exotic fruits even in the 80s in Poland. There were shortages, there were not many. Even Russia could provide them from, I don't know, Georgia or their own republic, but there were still shortages in Poland.
So were you saying there that the young pioneer sort of concept never took off in Poland?
No. Scouts, they provide, in Poland it was like two levels. For kids, which were Zuchy, they call him, so it was like up till 10 years old, and then once they reach central edge, they could join or be promoted to the proper scouts. And these proper scouts, actually uniforms, everything. Our scouts will look like this, let's say, paramilitary, something like that, uniforms, khaki, beige.
I mean, in the West, in the UK, certainly we had the Cub Scouts, which was the young, for younger kids, and then we had the proper scouts, which was for older kids. So it sounds like there was a similar set up to what you had in Poland.
What I've learned, what I've been told, because I was with scouts for 2 or 3 years, but I wasn't really interested in them. They were too much organized for me. I was always wandering my paths, and it wasn't for me. But I remember it was, we've been told, it was on the vision of Baden-Powell. Scouts were very popular because they tried to position themselves not as a state organization, but as independent. And they had to do lots of deeds for, you know, authorities, but they always tried to sell themselves as not controlled by authorities. So for that reason, they were popular.
How much was the church, the Catholic Church, an influence in your day-to-day life?
Quite a lot and nothing, really. It's very difficult to explain because, from one hand, in terms of how much, as a lot, I was raised in Catholic faith, and I was baptized, and then all the sacraments. Being, you know, active member of church, I mean, following to Mass, you know, Sunday or something, was quite a statement of defiance to the system. They had sometimes meetings after church as a community, officially as a community, but they were talking about this kind of anti-communist stuff. So church was involved in this anti-communist movement to some extent. Me was raised in this Catholic way. It's because my grandparents from my dad's side. But on the other hand, the same grandparents who were, you know, devoted Catholics, they teach me that it's me who has to have like freedom of thinking. I do need to keep open mind and never follow narrow path of thinking, because they grown up, my grandparents, in the area when they, you had as well Lutherans, you had Czech Brethren, you had some other faiths and Russian Orthodox, so, and Jewish before Second World War. So they grown up in seven religion, you know, seven different rites of Christianity and religion. So they were quite open-minded. And they, even within my family, I think some of my family from my grandparents are actually Lutherans, not Catholics. And they were said, I was on the back foot with authorities in from '80s. I was listening to, you know, punk music. As we're talking about 83, 84. Then I stopped going to the church because I thought, why should go every Sunday? What the heck? I have different ideas for spending Sundays. No one gonna tell me how I'm gonna live. But I didn't go to the state organized, you know, celebration and stuff. So 1st of May, you know, when we always have to celebrate, I used to be, you know, wandering around town, but never, you know, looking, you know, member of this, always finding excuse for my school, because you had to be at school, it was mandatory, but my mom was good and dad just writing, you know, notes that I'm sick or whatever, not to go there.
Were your parents involved in Solidarity? Solidarity was a free trade union authorized by the Polish Communist Party after widespread worker protests in the Baltic shipyards. In December 1981, Solidarity was made illegal as martial law was declared.
Yes, at the beginning, when it broke out, my mum joined, my dad joined, but my mum dropped membership of Solidarity when on December 1981. Martial law and everything was declared. Some mum renounced her membership of Solidarity because she had to keep her job. Anyway, because there was purge through the teachers' ranks. Most of the teachers were members of Solidarity at the beginning of movement, till martial law declared, and then those who still were members of Solidarity were arrested. I'm using arrested word, officially it was called interned, but it was proper arrest under pretension that it's not.
I can imagine they were saying, well, you're under protective custody or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, but, you know, but it wasn't different to proper arrest, really.
So there was no trial, you're just held.
Yes, and many of teachers were those who didn't renounce their Solidarity membership. They were kept there. Some people were stayed there for several weeks, some for several months, and I know at least two persons who were done 18 months terms.
Wow. What about your father?
He was member of Solidarity, but he didn't drop membership. It's because they stopped doing anything. Just for a few weeks, it was on total lockdown. Country was on total lockdown. And my dad was working with this state-controlled service of radio stuff, TV stuff, and that kind of thing. Because they become under army, let's say, security forces control. So they were like reorganized, split, and some parts, some people from his team were moved in other area, and he couldn't, you know, meet with other colleagues and stuff. He was never a proper fighter. He was member, but he prefers like sitting on a couch or sofa and watching TV than, you know, doing any mass protest on the streets. He never renounced this membership, but then it just like they split them and nothing happened.
Now, you're 11 years old, I think, when martial law's declared. What do you remember of that period?
The most, it's winter. Well, one of the best winters I remember. I mean, proper white, loads of snow, not too cold. I mean, not too cold is like minus 10, but bear in mind I'm Polish, so for me not too cold is minus 10. With quite dry weather, so you didn't feel this cold. Absolutely beautiful. And few days before this martial law declared, a few days before 13th of December, we had proper snowfall. So it's the reason why because everything was covered with proper few inch of snow, white, nice, tidy, looked really well. We lived by 81. It was our new second house because we moved from block of flats to this area. We lived next door to place of police, with the main building of police, local police, and security office, security services, was in our Jawor, in our town. It was four-story building, big, massive building, 1930s, by Germans for the same purpose, you know, for German police and I think security forces or something. So proper brick building with a backyard full of workshop garages and stuff. You could look like fortress really from outside. And we lived in two, three buildings for the family or for the staff working there. So in fact, this police building and our building where we lived was, in the past, it was like one part of complex. And access to our buildings when we lived was only through the backyard, through the, you know, of the police. And it was never a problem. We used to say hello, even, you know, they had own canteen. So sometimes even my mom was sending me to the canteen because when she was late and dad was late, so to have dinner there and stuff. But then 13th December and early morning, we got up and we couldn't catch a program which we used to on TV. It was Sunday, so we were off school. So we went to dad, you know, dad, you know how to TV, it's not working. And dad said, come, hang on, it's working. It must be working because there's nothing wrong with TV. And then he just changed, because it was channel number two, we had two channels. He changed number one, and it was official declare of this martial law by General Jaruzelski. And everyone was just like silence at home. My mom, oh, it's going to be war. We were convinced that it's really war. It's happening. We're expecting something shooting going to happen. And we look through the window, and there are plenty of personal armored cars. I think it was Scots, they used to call Scots, or BRDMs, and outside on our street, like five or six of them, and plenty uniform, I mean field uniform. We fought soldiers. We fought, at the time, we thought they were soldiers because there was something like ZOMO, which is a motorized reserve of police forces. And they were dressed and looked like proper army. And they were equipped like army. I mean, this armored, you know, carriers and vehicle carriers and stuff. And it was them, actually. They were properly trained to suppress any protest and stuff. But it was loads of them, like ants through the window when we look. But then they disappeared. These vehicles just dispersed about 11, 12 o'clock. They gone. And it was quiet. All of the town was quiet. And on TV only repeated this, you know, big talk about declared martial law and stuff. So with brother, we decided, okay, let's play with the snow. We took our sledges. And as we used to go to the backyard of the police station, because in the backyard they have a ramp for servicing vehicles. And it was a big ramp. And we used this ramp as an artificial hill to, you know, run sledges down. It was always, every year we used to do it, minimum five, seven of us. They went with sledges, you know, to play. We treat the backyard of police station as a playground. And to our surprise, within one night, they managed to build a fence around this police station. And there were soldiers who were fending this fence and telling us to bug off. Not to mess with them. They were strangers, not local, because every local police and knew that kids from this neighborhood. So we come back home and we said that we couldn't get there. We couldn't play because the fence, my dad looked through the window. Yes, it is. My mom, oh, what are we going to do? And something. So they went and talked. So they called neighbors, and there were a few of them. They called again someone in charge, and because there were a few people, so they suddenly, you know, started listening. And they explained that okay, kids, we understand that kids can't play, but you just blocked only access we have to our buildings. Can you do something to access? Because we cannot go to the street because our buildings are behind police station, and we have only access through the police station gateway. I tried to ask Dad what is going to be. He said that it's not going to be long. It's going to be like him being in Czechoslovakia. It's going to be just a few months and back. I remember him saying to Mom that it's going to be like maybe 6 weeks or something and it's done. He hoped. But it was different story. So that day, I remember us, you know, having opportunity to, you know, being great day for snow play, you know, play with snow. And it's been spoiled by the police or, let's say, suppression forces. It's perspective of the, you know, 10, 11 years old. Yeah, Mom, because we were talking later, I mean, years later, Mom was really scared that something gonna happen. Why she was scared? Because my granddad, her dad, worked and was retired with the security forces. And she knew that lots of people were disappeared without a trace in the past, in the 50s, 60s. And she knew from her dad, who was maybe involved, maybe not. I never get to this bottom. But she knew that this is quite grave danger if it goes this way. Then, following days, I think, there was gossip that Russians gonna get into the Poland, invade.
I was going to say, you had a great story from this time about your dad and some coke.
Yes, it's just...
What we mean by coke is the stuff that you use for a fire, not the drink or the drug.
Yes. It was chaotic time when they introduced martial law, and it was harsh winter, so you have to heat your home. In our home, we had central heating, which was fueled by coke. We were running low, even before December. And finally, my dad, as I said, loads of stuff, commodities, were regulated by state. So you had, you could have money, but doesn't mean you can get it because you had to have extra voucher for this. So finally, my dad got, before even martial law was introduced, this voucher for 5 tons of coke. It was a week later after martial law was introduced. He went to town to organize and to buy 5 tons of coke. And he agreed with the local people that they're going to deliver coke to our home. So he organized a truck, lorry, to deliver, gave them an address, but they couldn't figure out where is it. As I said earlier, our buildings were not directly within on a street. They were in a background backyard of the police station, so they're not visible, and no one knew the name, numbers of this building. My dad said, okay, I'm going to go with you in a truck, in a lorry, and show you how to get there. So they're driving with this 5 tons of coke, and they're approaching street, and as I said, gateway, which we used to go to our house, was shared, was the gateway to police station, big one. And in front of gateway, you have two armed, you know, figures, look, yeah, soldiers like off. And my dad said, you know, they're approaching the police station. And my dad said, okay, please turn this way, and pointing at the gateway. And the driver just looked at my dad with eyes like bloody, I don't know, $1 coin, big eyes, you know, scared, and said, very heavy swearing. You fucking, what do you think? You're going to arrest me? Because he was convinced that my dad was provocateur of secret police who tried to nick him for selling like extra, I don't know, 1 ton of coke or something. He said to my dad, you idiot, you know, you could do whatever you want with your car, but I'm not driving there. And he just put foot on a speed, you know, pedal, and drive quick in the next to the police station, just quick through the street to disappear from the, you know, with my dad. He was so convinced that my dad worked for police that my dad had to came back following day with big 2 bottles of vodka to apologize and to explain that the only way to get to our houses is to the police backyard.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information. Did you see any solidarity demonstrations or anything like that during that period, or was it quite quiet in your town as far as any dissent?
Oh, no. In the beginning, there were a few, yes. In the market square, our town, Javor, is typical like German town. You have market square surrounded by big, you know, buildings from each side, and market town square quite big. I can and there's monument regarding this area coming back to Polish lands. Twice, I remember, I was witness because active members were gathering in the front of this monument, but loads of bystanders, because this market town allowed lots of bystanders, let's say semi-hiding, those who were scared of being exposed as anti-communists in terms of business. You know, some people didn't want to fall out with authorities. So they were like bystanders. They pretend to being bystanders, but at the same time, being there, they were demonstrating support. Once, I remember, they were not lasting long, this demonstration. Police, they arrived quick and nicked them very quickly. It happens once I was going somewhere, and then I've noticed, oh, there's lots of people on the market square, so let's see what's going on. So I was witness, and it was like a week after martial law happened. So it's still December, before Christmas time, I think. And another one in January, I was in a shop somewhere, and I've overheard that it's going to be something, you know, in queue or something. So I was there for purpose. There was lots of people, bystanders, as I said, gathering earlier. Then these few brave appeared, and I didn't see how it ended. Obviously, they were nicked because someone grabbed me from behind, and it was my mom, which I got massive blocking. I didn't know what for, because I said I did nothing wrong, something. I was dragged home by mom. Even I was 11 years, quite big lad already. But that most humiliating thing was actually dragging by her, you know, because mom dragged me home, and it was most humiliating. And at home, I was shouted. I mean, mom shouted at me that I'm totally brainless, stupid, idiot, because they do photographs. And that way I can put some family in kind of trouble. When my mom and dad talk, it was always they will do photographs, surveillance you, monitor you, that invisible force who looking at you.
Yeah, and she's worried about her job as well,
yes,
isn't she?
Yes, because she was part of the system. And she had already kind of position within the system, you know, as an inspector of nurseries and primary education in our district. So she was quite scared of losing her job.
Could you travel very far in that period, or were there checkpoints on the roads?
At the beginning, there were checkpoints just around the corner, literally. In a town, on the outskirts of town, there were checkpoints. You have to have a special pass to go further. But I mean, outside of town, it means you couldn't go even to the nearest village. You have to have this pass. And to get pass on the beginning, my mom was actually worried about her dad, that one retired security, you know, officer. How he gonna cope or something. And they lived in a village not nearby, 10 miles from Yavor. So to get this pass, you had to have several stamps from different offices. I mean, police, local authorities, something else. I can't remember what. So it was quite complicated on the very beginning, because I'm talking about first weeks of this martial law. Then situation eased, but first weeks were really difficult to move around, really difficult. On a distance of 10 miles, we had three checkpoints when we were traveling. In deep snow, in this Fiat, you know, 1-6, going there, and we had this three checkpoints. And most of this, they were checking, actually, if we're smuggling anything. I mean, smuggling, it's not people think weapons or something. No, smuggling like half of pig, you know, from slaughter. there were shortages of food. So people were smuggling food from villages to the town in a barter exchange for something we guess. I think for sugar mostly. So the most popular mean of good for barter was actually sugar, cigarettes, vodka. In exchange, you
could all the basic staples.
Yeah, pretty much. And my dad, because he didn't smoke, and on this rationing book, he always got you had cigarettes. He converted one of the drawers for stash for cigarettes, and it was his currency. If he wants to get something, and I'm talking about first months after this martial law, money became quite useless. You know, money as a currency. They were worthless because no one really wanted, unless it was Western currency like dollars, pounds. Oh, yeah, so you talk different way. But usually it was a barter exchange for cigarettes, alcohol, petrol was one of these commodities everyone wanted, and sugar. Or you could exchange even Russian book coupons. Russian book coupons became quite of currency.
The Polish economy had sort of fallen apart by the early 80s. So there were shortages of so many things that you were having to barter to get hold of.
Yes.
Things.
It started to fall apart from 78, I think. From late 78, it starts showing signs of pop collapse. But 1980, 81, when they introduced this martial law with lockdown, and it's gone. We had like no economy anymore. You go to the shops, literally empty shelves, just like display of furniture. Queues to the shops, massive. Well, if you can imagine, like 200 yards queue. In the summertime, they used to bring from Soviet Union. Soviet Union tried to ease our situation to avoid public anger. So we get from Soviet Union extra melons, some citrus, that you know, that kind of fruits. To ease, you know, but it was not enough. And it was gossip. Oh, this shop on that day at particular hour will have extra supply of, I remember it was melons. Our neighbor told me, mom, that they gonna have melons on particular day because she worked there. So following day, my mom sent me to stay in a queue. You just like people used to send their kids to stay in a queue. And then afternoon we were swap over with our parents. So my mom came to buy just bloody one melon. It's unbelievable, you know. But shortages, how it can be.
1983, the curfew's removed. And you mentioned earlier about your grandmother being a forced labor worker in Germany during World War II. And you take her to a visit to Dresden, which was where she was a forced laborer. Can you tell me about that?
Yes. My grandma, she was taken as a forced labor when she was 13 or 12, some very young girl to help in some farm in Germany. But because she was quite fragile and not used to for hard farmer work, so once she was in Germany in 1940, 41, someone decided to swap her over with, and she became cook assistant in kitchen in Köln, I think Köln, she said, Köln and Düsseldorf area. And she worked in as a kitchen assistant there and waitress as a young girl. she grew up quickly German, so she learned German quite quick. The owner of the business was the old couple, so they started to treat her as a daughter, really, because she, they like her, and they treat her quite all right, on the same terms like German workers there. And she was there till 1944. In 1944, there was big bombardment of Allies in this area. And she thought, okay, I'm going to escape. I'm going back to Poland, to family. And she said, she always repeating that, listen, I was young. I was 15 years old. Not realize danger, I decide, okay, I'm going to back to Poland. I'm fed up with this. I'm going. And she was confident, you know, in her German. So she took a train without ticket, without anything, going to the east part of Germany. And she sit in a carriage, confident, and let's go. And she said her travel last quite long because she got involved in talk with co-passengers, Germans. No one realized that she's forced labor. Just her confidence, pace, you know. And she managed to get to the Dresden area, and she get off the carriage on a station. And there was patrol of police, German Reich police, and asking for papers. And she said, and she was, again, confident. She said, I have no papers. And she said, I have no, so where are you from? Or, what you do? And she said, I'm forced labor, and I don't know what to do because my, how to say, master's business was bombed, Robert, and they died. And I'm only one, and I don't know what to do. Some wander around, and if you can't find me another place, that's fine. So she was taken to police station. On police, the head of police or whoever was, how to say, running this case, you don't do anything yourself. We are the one who find to work for you, not yourself. Because they believed she really looked for job. So she was. So she stayed in Dresden. She was allocated again as a cougar assistant to some cafe restaurant in Dresden Square, town square. She worked there with, she said, there was another one, a forced labor from the Netherlands with her and two Russian girls. Because she said this restaurant, a cafe, was quite big and they used to come like lots of local elderly residents there for dinners and tea and serving. It was a restaurant and cellar, like two levels. It was really busy. But she, again, she had room with, girl from Netherlands, and they were getting on very well. Unfortunately, the bombing from February in 1945, they, owners of the business and German staff, they had allocated like shelters. So they also told them, you know, the forced labor staff, that they have to go with them. But my grandma decide, no, I know better, you know, and she just like run away, escape. It was just before bombing started. People were running, you know, all over the place from one area to another, just like bumping on each other. And she said that as soon as she get to the other side of the town square, bombs started to drop and exploding. And she got hit by some brick or something from falling building, and she lost consciousness. When she wake up, it was already bright day light, and she said smell was, but not smell like we think about bodies. It's just like, she said, like burning plastic. And she got up and couldn't move arm because, and she said it was like open wound from burning stuff, and it still had like wooden or something stuck in her arm, but she could walk. Everything else was okay. She said she looked from dust like white person, like ghost, full dust. And then some firefighters, or she said, or some others, people in uniform like firefighters came and asking her, said that she was from that place and so. And he just pointed out, and it was nothing there. It was like empty place, leveled down completely, this part of town. And so she went there, and it was just pile of rubble. And she said, even this shelter where it's supposed to go, everyone was collapsed. And she said, everyone died. Everyone died from, you know, this place. And she said she was marching to the river quite slow. She said it was painful, slow walk to the river, half day. And it was from town center to the river. It's not far, it's short distance, but for her it was like half day, painful walk because she couldn't barely move. And it was filled hospital set up quickly by Germans. And she said, one thing I still remember, they didn't ask who I am from. They treat everyone as it goes. No, they didn't make any difference. There's lots. And she said, like, it was people to the horizon, loads of people to the horizon. And they moved people across the river, across the bank. Soon, the same day, she was moved to another field hospital where there was no tents, just like people were laying on a bare ground. She was told to stay there. She stayed there for 2 days because dressing for her wound, you know, had to change. And then some doctor or whoever is German said, okay, you go where you want. I'm not going to tell anything. Just it was time when no one cared about if she was forced labor or not. Germans were busy with their own. I said, okay, go. And she walked literally from Dresden to Poland. She was given even bicycle by this doctor. On bicycle tried to go, but bicycle was stolen still in it's still Germany, but by Polish army. She was Pole. You know, Polish, coming back home to Poland, and the Polish Communist Army was, you know, approaching. And what they did, she said, oh, lucky I wasn't raped, but they stole my bike. So she walked further down and was given lift by some people from another Polish, you know, people from this Polish army. And finally she got to Poland.
It's now 1983 and martial law has ended in Poland. The Polish authorities are now allowing their citizens to travel abroad to selected countries.
We could go only to Bulgaria, you know, other communist. But it was something. East Germany was just around the corner, really, 100 miles. And we thought, okay, we have opportunity, we have passports. Let's get grandma. She talked a few times about Dresden. Let's go to Dresden. It was a short day trip. I never been to Dresden before, so I didn't know how it is. First thing, we went to Zwinger, to this Baroque palace, you know, to see some. And then with grandma, we went to the town center, and she was quite quiet all the time. And suddenly she said, no, it's not Dresden. And we said, hang on, we are in Dresden. We are right now in town center. And she still looked, no, it's not Dresden. You took me somewhere else. It's not Dresden. A few times we tried, but she was adamant, it's not Dresden. End of. And she said, it's Germany. Yeah, she spoke with people in the German, you know, German people. Quite friendly. And she was really live, you know. I didn't understand German by then. I didn't, because I didn't learn. But I tell you, fluent German. She spoke with these people, and she came to alive. I've never seen her as I remember. It was only time when she was really sparkly, you know, bright eyes. talking language, gestures, and she was really happy there, really. But then we came back, and after we came back, it was our next visit to grandma, when she actually, the first time and the only time, when she told us in very bright picture, very bright colors picture, how it was, you know, how she survived, how she was lucky, because it was pure luck. And she showed us this scar. Since then, I think only once more she said about Dresden. It was when my cousin took her in 90s to Dresden. And Dresden was rebuilt by then. And she suddenly said, oh, I remember this was there. And our restaurant was there. But building is different. Because apparently Dresden was partially rebuilt. So she could navigate herself. And she started remembering, you know, even she said name of this restaurant. And, oh, it was Passage there. Said, but street is different. But in the 80s, when Dresden was still in rubble, she said, it's not Dresden. It's not my town.
Don't miss the episode extras, such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.